What will we do?
We'll walk fast is what we'll do, and we won't look back. Looking back doesn't do any good at all. No, none at all, said Zafira, and smiled and took his hand, and they walked quickly onward in silence. It was amazing, Theremin thought, how swiftly they were going, now that they had hit their stride. The first few days when they were coming down out of Sorrow City and picking their way through the wreckage-strewn upper end of the highway, progress had been slow, and their bodies had protested bitterly against the strains that they were imposing on them. But now they were moving like two machines, perfectly attuned to their task. Zafira's legs were nearly as long as his own, and they walked side by side, muscles working efficiently, hearts pumping steadily, lungs expanding and contracting in flawless rhythm. Stride, stride, stride. Stride, stride, stride. Stride, stride, stride. Hundreds of miles yet to go, sure, but it wouldn't take long, not at this pace. Another month, perhaps. Perhaps even less. The road was almost completely clear down here in the rural regions beyond the farthest edge of the city. There hadn't been nearly as much traffic here in the first place as there had been to the north, and it looked as though many of the drivers had been able to get off the highway safely, even while the stars were shining, since they were in less danger of being struck by the cars of other drivers who had lost control. There were fewer checkpoints, too. The new provinces in these sparsely populated areas covered much greater areas than those up north, and their people seemed less concerned with such things as search. Theremin and Zafira underwent serious interrogation only twice in the next 5 days. At the other border points, they were simply waved on through them without even having to show the papers Bine had provided for them. Even the weather was on their side. It was fair and mild almost every day. A few little rain showers now and then, but nothing that caused serious inconvenience. They would walk for 4 hours, pause for a light meal, walk another four, eat again, walk, stop for 6 hours or so of sleep, taking turns, one sitting up and watching for a few hours, then the other, and then get up and march onward, like machines. The suns came and went in the sky in their age-old rhythm, now Patru and Trey and Dovim up above, now Onos and Sitha and Tano, now Onos and Dovim, now Trey and Patru, now four suns at once, the unending succession, the great pageant of the skies. Theremin had no idea how many days had passed since they had left the sanctuary. The whole idea of dates, calendars, weeks, days, months, it all seemed quaint and archaic, and cumbersome to him, something out of a former world. Zafira, after her spell of brooding and apprehensiveness, became cheerful again. This was going to be a breeze. They would make it down to Umganda with no trouble at all. They were passing through a district known as Spring Glen now, or perhaps it was called Garden Grove. They had heard several different names from the people they encountered along the road. It was farm country, open and rolling, and there was little sign here of the hellish devastation that had blighted the urbanized regions. An occasional fire-damaged barn or a herd of farm animals that seemed to be roaming unattended, and that was about the worst of it. The air was sweet and fresh. The light of the suns was bright and strong. But for the eerie absence of vehicular traffic on the highway, it was possible here to think that nothing extraordinary had happened at all. Are we halfway to Umgando yet? Zafira asked. Not quite. I haven't seen a road sign for a while, but my guess is that... He stopped abruptly. What is it, Theremin? Look. Look there to the right, along that secondary road coming in from the west. They peered over the edge of the highway. Down below, a few hundred yards away, a long row of trucks was drawn up at the side of the secondary road, where it fed into an approach to the main one. There was a large bustling camp there, tents, a big campfire burning, some men chopping logs. 200 or 300 people, perhaps, all of them in black hooded robes. Theremin and Zafira exchanged astounded glances.
Apostles, she whispered.
Yes, get down, hands and knees. Hide yourself against the railing here. But how did they manage to get this far south so fast? The highway's upper end is completely blocked. Theremin shook his head. They didn't take the highway at all. Look there. They've got trucks that work. Here's another one coming right now. Gods, that looks strange, doesn't it? An actual moving vehicle. And hearing the sound of an engine again after all this time. He felt himself beginning to shiver. They were able to keep a fleet of trucks undamaged and a supply of fuel. And obviously they've come down from Sorrow around through the west on little country roads. Now they're joining up with the main highway.
which I suppose is open from here to Umgando. They could be there by this evening. This evening? Theremin, what are we going to do? I'm not sure. There's only one wild chance, I guess. What if we went down there and tried to seize one of those trucks, and drove it to Umgando ourselves? Even if we got there only 2 hours ahead of the Apostles, there'd be time for most of the Umgando people to escape, right? Sephara said, Perhaps. It sounds crazy, though. How could we steal a truck? The moment they see us, they'll know we aren't Apostles, and they'll grab us. I know. Let me think. After a moment, he said, If we could catch a couple of them at a distance from the others, and take their robes away from them, shoot them with our needlers if we have to, and then, when we're robed, just walk up to one of the trucks as though we have every right to be doing that, and jump on board and drive off toward the highway. They'd follow after us in 2 minutes. Maybe. Well, maybe if we were calm and cool about it, they'd think it was something perfectly ordinary, part of their plan. And by the time they realized it wasn't, we'd be 50 miles down the road. He looked at her eagerly. What do you say, Sephara? What other hope do we have? Continue toward Umgando on foot, when for us it'll be a journey of weeks and weeks, and they can drive past us in a couple of hours? She was staring at him as though he had lost his mind. Overpower a couple of Apostles? Hijack one of their trucks? Go zooming off toward Umgando? Oh, Theremin, it'll never work. You know that. All right, he said abruptly. You stay here. I'll try to do it alone. It's the only hope there is, Sephara. He rose to a half-crouch and began to scuttle along the side of the highway toward the exit ramp a few hundred yards ahead. No, wait, Theremin. He looked back at her and grinned. Coming? Yes. Oh, this is crazy. Yes, he said. I know. But what else can we do? She was right, of course. The scheme was crazy. Yet he saw no alternative. Evidently the report Binet had received had been garbled. The Apostles had never intended to move down the Great Southern Highway province by province, but instead had set out directly for Umgando in a huge armed convoy, taking minor roads, which, though not very direct, were at least still open to vehicular transport. Umgando was doomed. The world would fall by default to Mondior's people. Unless... He had never imagined himself as a hero. Heroes were people he wrote about in his column. People who functioned at the top of their form under extreme circumstances, performing strange and miraculous deeds that the ordinary individual would never dream of even attempting, let alone of carrying off. And now, here he was in this strangely transformed world, blithely talking of overpowering hooded cultists with his needle gun, commandeering a military truck, speeding off to Umgando Park to sound the warning of the oncoming attack. Crazy. Utterly crazy. But perhaps it might just work. Simply because it was so crazy. Nobody would be expecting two people to appear out of thin air down here in this peaceful, bucolic setting and simply run off with a truck. They edged their way down the highway ramp, Theremin a short distance in the lead. A thickly overgrown field lay between them and the camp of the Apostles. Maybe, he whispered, if we get down and wriggle through the tall grass here, and a couple of the Apostles come wandering out this way for some reason, we can rise up and jump them before they know what's happening. He got down. He wriggled. Sephara went right after him, keeping pace. 10 yards. 20. Just keep going. Head down and wriggle. Over to that little knoll. And then, wait. Wait. A voice said suddenly, just behind him, What do we have here? A couple of peculiar serpents, is it? Theremin turned, looked, gasped. Gods! Apostles! 7 or 8 of them! Where had they come from? A private picnic in the field, which he and Sephara had crawled right past all unknowing. Run for it, he barked to her. You go this way, I'll go that. He began to sprint to his left, toward the towers that supported the highway. Maybe he could outrun them, disappear into the wooded country on the other side of the road. No, he was strong and fast, but they were stronger, faster. He saw them coming up alongside him. Sephara, he yelled. Keep going, keep going. Perhaps she had actually made it to safety. He couldn't see her now. The Apostles were all around him. He reached for his needle gun, but one of them caught his arm immediately and another got him by the throat. The gun was yanked from his hand, legs poked between his, entangling him, tripping him. He fell heavily, rolled over, looked up. 5 hooded faces, unsmiling, rigid, looked back. One of the Apostles had his own needle gun aimed at his chest. Get up, the Apostle said. Slowly, with your hands in the air. Awkwardly, Theremin stumbled to his feet.
Who are you? What are you doing here?
The apostle demanded. I live around here. My wife and I were just taking a shortcut through these fields and back to our house.
The nearest farm is 5 miles away.
A very long shortcut. The apostle gestured with a nod of his head toward the camp.
Come with us. Voloman will want to talk to you.
Voloman. So he had survived the night of the eclipse after all, and was in charge of the expedition against Amgondo. Theramon glanced around. No sign of Sephira at all. He hoped she was back on the highway by now, heading for Amgondo as fast as she could go. A slim hope, but the only one left. The apostles marched him toward the camp. It was a weird sensation to be among so many hooded figures. Scarcely any of them paid attention to him, though, as his captors nudged him along into the largest of the tents. Voloman was seated at a bench near the back of the tent, looking through a sheaf of papers. He turned his chilly blue eyes on Theramon, and his thin, sharp face softened for an instant as a smile of surprise crossed it.
Theramon, you here? What are you doing, covering us for the Chronicle?
I'm traveling south, Voloman, taking a little holiday since things are a little unsettled back in the city. Would you mind asking these thugs of yours to let go of me?
Release him, Voloman said. Where are you heading, exactly, eh?
That's of no importance to you.
Let me be the judge of that. Going to Amgondo, are you, Theramon?
Theramon offered the cultist a cold, level stare. I don't see any reason why I should tell you anything.
After all that I told you when you interviewed me?
Very funny.
I want to know where you're heading, Theramon.
Stall, Theramon thought. Stall him as long as you can. I decline to answer that question or any other you might happen to have for me. I'll discuss my intentions only with Mondior himself, he said in a steady, determined tone. Voloman made no reply for a moment. Then he smiled again, a quick on-off. And then suddenly, unexpectedly, he broke into actual laughter. Theramon wondered if he had ever seen Voloman laugh before.
Mondior,
Voloman said, his eyes glinting with amusement.
There is no Mondior, my friend. There never was.
42. It was hard for Sephira to believe that she had actually managed to escape, but that was indeed what appeared to have happened. Most of the apostles who had surprised them in the field had gone after Theramon. Looking back once, she had seen them surrounding him like hunters' hounds surrounding their prey. They had knocked him down. He would certainly be captured. Only two of the apostles had split off to pursue her. Sephira had jabbed one in the face hard with the flat of her hand at the end of her stiff, outstretched arm, and at the speed she was traveling, the impact had sent him reeling to the ground. The remaining one was fat and ungainly and slow. In moments, Sephira left him far behind. She doubled back the way she and Theramon had come, toward the elevated highway. But it seemed unwise to go up onto it. The highway was too easily blocked, and there was no safe way down from it except at the exit ramps. She would only be putting herself at risk of running into a trap if she went up there. And even if no roadblocks lay ahead, it would be a simple thing for the apostles to come after her in their trucks and pick her up a mile or two down the way. No, the thing to do was run into the woods on the far side of the road. The apostles' trucks wouldn't be able to follow her there. She could lose herself easily enough in those low, shrubby trees and hide there until she had figured out her next move. And what could that be, she wondered. She had to admit that Theramon's idea, wild as it was, still was their only hope. Steal a truck somehow, drive down to Amgondo, and sound the alarm before the apostles could get their army on the move again. But Sephira knew there wasn't the remotest chance that she could simply tiptoe up to an empty truck, jump in, and drive it away. The apostles weren't that stupid. She'd have to order one of them at gunpoint to switch the truck on for her and surrender its controls to her. And that involved carrying out the whole bizarre maneuver of trying to overpower a stray apostle, getting his robe, slipping into the camp, locating someone who could open up one of the trucks for her. Her heart sank. It was all too implausible. She might just as well consider trying to rescue Theramon while she was at it. Go marching in with her needle gun blazing, take hostages, demand his immediate release. Oh, it was absolute foolishness. A silly, melodramatic dream, a gaudy maneuver out of some cheap children's adventure book. But what will I do? What will I do? She huddled down in a copse of tightly woven little trees with long feathery leaves and waited for time to pass. The apostles gave no sign of breaking camp. She could still see the smoke of their bonfire against the twilight sky, and their trucks were still parked where they had been along the road. Evening was coming on. Onos was gone from the sky. Dovim hovered on the horizon. The only suns overhead were her two least favorite ones, bleak and cheerless Tano and Setha, casting their cold light from their distant location at the edge of the universe. Or what people had thought was the edge of the universe, rather, in those far-off, innocent days before the stars appeared and revealed to them just how immense the universe really was. The hours ticked interminably by. No solution to the situation made sense to her. Umgando seemed lost. Unless someone else had managed to get a warning to them, certainly there was no way she was going to get there ahead of the apostles. Rescuing Theramun was an absurd idea. Her chances of stealing a truck and getting to Umgando by herself was only slightly less preposterous. What then? Simply sit back and watch while the apostles took command of everything? There seemed to be no alternative. At one point during the evening, she thought that the only path open to her was to walk into the apostles' camp, surrender, and ask to be imprisoned with Theramun. At least they would be together then. It astonished her how much she missed him. They had not been out of each other's company in weeks. She, who had never lived with a man in her life, and all during the long journey from Sorrow City, though they had bickered now and then, even quarreled a little, she had never tired of being with him. Not once. It had seemed the most natural thing in the world for them to be together. And now she was alone again. Go on, she told herself. Give yourself up. Everything's lost anyway, isn't it? It grew darker. Clouds veiled Setha and Tano's frosty light, and the sky turned so dusky that she half expected the stars to reappear. Go ahead, she thought bitterly. Come out and shine. Drive everyone crazy all over again. What harm can it do? The world can only be smashed once, and that's been done already. But the stars, of course, did not appear. Veiled as they were, Tano and Setha nevertheless afforded enough light to mask the glow of those distant points of mysterious brilliance. And as the hours went by, Sephira found herself swinging completely around from her mood of total defeatism to a new sense of almost reckless hope. When all is lost, she told herself, there's nothing left to lose. Under cover of this evening gloom, she would slip into the apostles' camp and somehow, take one of their trucks and rescue Theramun too if she could manage it, and then off to Umgando. By the time Onos was in the sky tomorrow morning, she'd be down there among her university friends in plenty of time to let them know that they had to scatter before the enemy army arrived. All right, she thought. Let's go. Slowly, more cautiously than before, just in case they have sentries hidden in the grass. Out of the woods. A moment of uncertainty there. She felt tremendously vulnerable now that she had left the safety of that tangle of shrubbery behind. But the dimness still protected her. Across the cleared place now that led from the woods to the elevated highway, under the great metal legs of the roadbed, and into the unkempt field where she and Theramun had been surprised that afternoon. Get down and wriggle now, the way they had before. Once again across the field, looking this way and that, scanning for sentries who might be on duty at the perimeter of the apostles' camp. Her needle gun was in her hand, set for minimum aperture, the sharpest, most highly focused, deadliest beam the gun could produce. If anyone came upon her now, so much the worse for him. There was too much at stake to worry about the niceties of civilized morality. While still half out of her mind, she had killed Balik in the archaeology lab, not meaning to, but he was dead all the same. And, a little to her surprise, she found herself quite ready to kill again, this time intentionally, if circumstances required it of her. The important thing was to get a vehicle and get out of here and carry the news of the Apostles' army's approach to Umgando. Everything else, including considerations of morality, was secondary. Everything. This was war. Onward. Head down, eyes raised, body hunched. She was only a few dozen yards from the camp now. It was very silent over there. Probably most of them were asleep. In the murky grayness, Sephira thought she could see a couple of figures on the far side of the main bonfire, though the smoke rising from the fire made it difficult to be sure. The thing to do, she thought, was to slip into the deep shadows behind one of the trucks and toss a rock against a tree some distance away. The sentries would probably investigate, and if they fanned out separately, she could slip up behind one of them, jab the needler into his back, warn him to keep quiet, make him strip off his robe. No, she thought. Don't warn him of anything. Just shoot him, quickly, and take his robe before he can call out an alarm. These are apostles, after all. Fanatics. Her own newfound cold-bloodedness amazed her. Onward. Onward. She was almost at the nearest truck now, into the darkness on the side opposite the campfire. Where's a rock? Here. Here, this is a good one. Shift the needler to the left hand for a moment. Now, toss the rock at that big tree over there. She raised her arm to make the throw, and in that moment she felt a hand seize her left wrist from behind and a powerful arm clamp across her throat. Caught. Shock and outrage and a jolt of maddening frustration went coursing through her. Furiously, Sephira lashed out with her foot, kicking backward with all her strength and connecting. She heard a grunt of pain, not enough to break the man's strong grip, though. Twisting halfway around, she kicked again and attempted at the same time to pass the needle gun from her left hand to her right. But her assailant pulled her left arm upward in a short, sharp, agonizing gesture that numbed her and sent the needler spilling out of her hand. The other arm, the one that was pressing against her throat, tightened to choking intensity. She coughed and gasped. Darkness, of all the stupidity to let someone sneak up on her while she was sneaking up on them. Tears of rage burned her cheeks. In fury, she kicked backward again, and then again.
Easy, a deep voice whispered. You could hurt me that way, Sephira.
Theremin? She said, astounded. Who do you think it is, Mondior? The pressure at her throat eased. The hand that clutched her wrist released its grasp. She took a couple of tottering steps forward, fighting for breath. Then, numb with confusion, she swung around to stare at him.
How did you get free?
She asked. He grinned. A holy miracle it was, an absolute holy miracle. I watched you the whole time coming from the woods. You were very good, really. But you were concentrating so hard on getting here unnoticed that you didn't notice me circling around behind you.
Thank all the gods it was you, Theremin. Even if you did give me the shock of my life when you grabbed me. But why are we standing here? Quick, let's grab one of those trucks and clear out of here before they see us.
No, he said. That isn't the plan anymore. She gave him a blank look.
I don't understand.
You will. To her amazement, he clapped his hands and called loudly. Over here, fellas. Here she is.
Theremin! Are you out of your...
The beam of a flashlight struck her in the face with an impact nearly as devastating as the one the stars had had. She stood blinded, shaking her head in bewilderment and consternation. There were figures moving all around her, but it was another moment before her eyes adapted sufficiently to the sudden brightness for her to make them out. Apostles. Half a dozen of them. She glared accusingly at Theremin. He seemed calm and very pleased with himself. Her dazed mind could barely begin to accept the awareness that he had betrayed her. When she tried to speak, nothing but blurted monosyllables would emerge.
But why? What?
Theremin smiled. Come on, Sephira. There's someone I want you to meet. 43. Balaman said,
There's not really any need to glower at me like that, Dr. Sephira. You may have trouble believing it, but you are among friends here.
Friends? You must think I'm a very gullible woman.
Not at all. Quite to the contrary.
You invade my laboratory and steal priceless research materials. You order your horde of berserk superstitious followers to invade the observatory and wreck the equipment with which the university astronomers are trying to perform unique, essential research. And now you hypnotize Theremin into doing your bidding and send him out to capture me and turn me over to you as a prisoner. And then you tell me that I'm among friends? Theremin said quietly, I haven't been hypnotized, Sephira, and you aren't a prisoner. Oh, of course not. And this is all just a very bad dream, too. Nightfall, the fires, the collapse of civilization, the whole thing. An hour from now, I'll wake up in my apartment in Sorrow City, and everything will be just the way it was when I went to sleep. Theremin, facing her across the middle of Foliman's tent, thought that she had never looked more beautiful than she did right then. Her eyes were luminous with anger. Her skin seemed to glisten. There was an aura of intensely focused energy about her that he found irresistible. But this was hardly the moment to tell her anything like that. Foliman said,
For stealing your tablets, Dr. Sephira, I can only offer my apologies. It was a shameless act of theft, which I assure you I never would have authorized, except that you made it necessary.
I made it!
You did. You insisted on keeping them in your possession, on placing those irreplaceable relics of the previous cycle in jeopardy at a time when chaos was about to break loose. And, for all you knew, the university buildings were going to be destroyed down to the last brick. We saw it as essential that they be placed in safekeeping, That is to say, in our own hands. And since you would not authorize that, we found it necessary to take them from you.
I found those tablets. You'd never have known they existed if I hadn't dug them up.
Which is beside the point, Fahlemann said smoothly. Once the tablets were discovered, they became vital to our needs, to humanity's needs. We felt the future of Kalgash was more important than your personal proprietary interest in your artifacts. As you will see, we have translated the tablets fully now, making use of the ancient textual material already available to us, and they have added greatly to our understanding of the extraordinary challenges that civilized life on Kalgash must periodically confront. Dr. Mudrin's translations were unfortunately extremely superficial, but the tablets provide an accurate and convincing version, uncorrupted by centuries of textual alteration and error, of the chronicles that have come down to us under the name of the Book of Revelations. The Book of Revelations, I must confess, is full of mysticism and metaphor, adapted for propagandistic purposes. The Thambo tablets are straightforward, historical accounts of two separate advents of the stars thousands of years ago, and of the attempts made by the priesthoods of the time to warn the populace of what was about to happen. We can demonstrate now that throughout history and prehistory on Kalgash, small groups of dedicated people have struggled again and again to prepare the world for the disruption that repeatedly falls upon it. The methods they used, obviously, were insufficient to the problem. Now, at last, aided as we are by a knowledge of past mistakes, we will be able to spare Kalgash from another devastating upheaval when the present year of godliness comes to its end 2,000 years from now.
Sephera turned to Theramon. How smug he sounds, justifying his own burglary of my tablets by telling me that they'll enable him to set up an even more efficient theocratic dictatorship than they had hoped.
Theramon, why did you sell me out like this? Why did you sell us out? We could have been halfway to Umgando by this time if only...
Fahlemann said,
You'll be in Umgando tomorrow afternoon, Dr. Sephera. I assure you, all of us will be in Umgando by tomorrow afternoon.
What will you do? She asked hotly. March me in chains at the rear of your conquering army? Tie me up and make me walk in the dust behind Mondior's chariot? The apostle sighed.
Theramon, explain things to her, if you please.
No, she said. Her eyes were blazing. You poor brainwashed ninny. I don't want to hear the gibberish this maniac has poured into your mind. I don't want to hear anything from any of you. Let me alone. Lock me up if you like, or turn me loose if you can bring yourself to do it. I can't possibly harm you, can I? One woman against a whole army? I can't even cross a field without having someone come up and surprise me from behind. Theramon, dismayed, reached toward her. No, keep away from me. You disgust me. But it isn't your fault, is it? They've done something to your mind. You'll do it to me too, won't you, Fahlemann? You'll make me into an obliging little puppet. Well, let me ask just this one favor. Don't force me to wear an apostle's robe. I can't stand the idea of walking around inside one of those ridiculous things. Take my soul away if you have to, but let me dress as I please, all right? All right, Fahlemann? The apostle laughed faintly.
Perhaps it would be best if I left the two of you alone. I can see that nothing's going to be accomplished so long as I'm part of the conversation.
Sephera cried, No, damn you, I don't want to be left alone with... But Fahlemann had already risen and walked quickly from the tent. Theramon turned toward Sephera, who backed away from him as though he were carrying some plague. Softly, he said, I wasn't hypnotized, Sephera. They haven't done anything to my mind. Of course you'd say that. It's true. I'll prove it to you. She stared at him bleakly, coldly, making no response. Very quietly, he said after a moment, Sephera, I love you. How long did it take the apostles to program that line into you? She asked. He winced. Don't. Don't. I mean it, Sephera. I won't try to tell you that I've never said those words to anyone before, but this is the first time I've meant them. Oldest line in the book, said Sephera derisively. I suppose I deserve that. Theramon the ladies' man. Theramon the seducer about town. Well, all right. Forget I said it. No, I'm serious, Sephera. Traveling with you these past weeks, being with you morning and afternoon and evening, there hasn't been a moment when I haven't looked at you and thought to myself, this is the woman I was waiting for all those years. This is the woman I never dared to imagine I would find.
Very touching, Theramon. And the best way you could find to show your love was to grab me from behind, practically breaking my arm in the process, and turn me over to Mondior, right?
Mondior doesn't exist, Sephira. There's no such person. For an instant, he saw a flicker of surprise and curiosity cut through her hostility.
What?
He's a convenient, mythical construct, put together by electronic synthesis to make speeches on television. No one's ever had an audience with him, have they? He's never been seen in public. Solomon invented him to be a public spokesman. Since Mondior never appears in person, he can be on television in 5 different countries all at once, all over the world. Nobody could ever be sure where he really was, and so he could be displayed simultaneously. Solomon's the real boss of the Apostles of Flame. He simply masquerades as a public relations officer. In fact, he calls all the shots, and has for the past 10 years. Before that, there was someone named Basrit, who's dead now. Basrit was the one who invented Mondior, but Folliman's brought him to his present eminence.
Folliman told you all this?
He told me some, I guessed the rest, and he confirmed it. He'll show me the Mondior apparatus when we're back in Sorrow City. The Apostles plan to restore television transmissions in another few weeks.
All right, Sephira said harshly. The discovery that Mondior's a fake so overwhelmed you with its slimy cleverness that you decided on the spot that you absolutely had to join up with Folliman's outfit. And your first assignment was to turn me in. So you skulked around looking for me and took me by surprise and thereby made certain that the people down in Umgando would fall into Folliman's clutches. Nicely done, Theramon.
Folliman's heading for Umgando, yes, Theramon said. But he doesn't intend to harm those who have gathered there. He wants to offer them posts in the new government.
God's almighty, Theramon, do you believe...
Yes, yes, Sephira. Theramon held his hands out, fingers spread wide in an agitated gesture. I may be a mere coarse journalist, but at least grant me that I'm no fool. 20 years in the newspaper business has made me an excellent judge of character at the very least. Folliman impressed me in a strange way from the first time I met him. He seemed very much the opposite of crazy, very complex, very sly, very sharp. And I've been talking with him for the past 8 hours. Nobody's been sleeping here this evening. He's laid his whole plan bare. He's shown me his entire scheme. Would you grant, for the sake of argument, that it's possible for me to get an accurate psychological reading on someone during the course of an 8-hour conversation?
Well, she said grudgingly, either he's completely sincere, Sephira, or he's the best actor in the world.
He could be both. That still doesn't make him someone we'd want to trust.
Maybe not, but I do. Now.
Go on.
Folliman is a totally ruthless, almost monstrously rational man who believes that the only thing that's of any real importance is the survival of civilization. Because he's had access, through his age-old religious cult, to historical records of previous cycles, he's known for many years what we've all just learned in the hardest possible way, that Kalgash is doomed to be shown a view of the stars once every 2,000 years, and that the sight of them is so overwhelming that it'll shatter ordinary minds and give even the strongest ones a bad time for days or weeks. He's willing to let you see all their ancient documents, by the way, when we're back in Sorrow City. Sorrow City has been destroyed. No, not the part of it controlled by the Apostles. They made damned well sure nobody would be setting any fires within a mile of their tower on all sides.
Very efficient of them, Sephira said.
They're efficient people. All right, Folliman knows that in a time of total madness, the best hope of pulling things together is a religious totalitarianism. You and I may think the gods are just old fables, Sephira, but there are millions and millions of people out there, believe it or not, who have a different view of things. They've always been uneasy about doing things that they consider sinful, for fear the gods will punish them. And now they have an absolute dread of the gods. They think the stars might come back tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, and finish off the job. Well, here are the Apostles, who claim a direct pipeline to the gods, and have all sorts of scriptural passages to prove it. They're in a better position to set up a world government than Altenall, or the little provincial overlords, or the fugitive remnants of the former governments, or anyone else. They're the best hope we have.
You're serious, Sephira said in wonder.
Folliman hasn't hypnotized you, Theramon. You've managed to do it to yourself.
Look, he said, Folliman's been working all his life toward this moment, knowing that his is the generation of apostles on whom the responsibility for ensuring survival will fall. He's got all sorts of plans. He's well on his way to establishing control over enormous territories north and west of Sorrow City. And next, he's going to take charge of the new provinces along the line of the Great Southern Highway. And establish a theocratic dictatorship that will begin its rule by executing all the atheistic, cynical, materialistic university people like Binet and Sheeran and me. Sheeran's already dead. Solomon told me his people found his body in a ruined house. He was apparently killed some weeks back by a band of anti-intellectual crazies. Sephira looked away, unable for a moment to meet Theremin's eyes. Then she stared at him more angrily than before and said, "There you are! First, Solomon sends his goons crashing into the observatory. Aethor was killed too, wasn't he? And then he eliminates poor, harmless Sheeran. And then all the rest of us will be..." He was trying to protect the observatory people, Sephira. He didn't go about it very well, did he? Things got out of hand. What he wanted to do was rescue all the scientists before the rioting started. But because he was operating under the guise of a wild-eyed fanatic, he had no way of persuading them to hear what he was offering, which was to give them safe conduct to the Apostles' Sanctuary. After the observatory was wrecked, that wasn't his first choice either. The world was crazy that night. Things didn't always follow his scheme. "You're very good at making excuses for him, Theremin." "Well, maybe so. Hear me out anyway. He wants to work with the surviving university people and the other sane and intelligent ones who have gathered at Umgando to rebuild humanity's pool of knowledge. He, or the supposed Mondior, rather, will be in charge of the government. The apostles will keep the unstable and superstition-ridden populace pacified by religious domination, at least for a generation or two. Meanwhile, the university people will help the apostles assemble and codify the knowledge they've managed to save, and together they'll guide the world back to a rational state, as has happened so many times before. But this time, perhaps, they'll be able to begin the preparations for the next eclipse, 100 years or so in advance, and head off the worst of the upheaval, the mass insanity, the torchings, the universal devastation." "And you believe all this?" Sephira asked. There was the bite of acid in her voice. "That it makes sense to stand back and applaud while the apostles of flame spread their poisonous, irrational, totalitarian creed throughout the world? But what's even worse, that we should join forces with them?" "I hate the idea," Theremin said suddenly. Sephira's eyes widened. "Then why?" "Let's go outside," he said. "It's almost dawn. Give me your hand." "Well, it wasn't just a line when I told you I love you." She shrugged. "One thing has nothing to do with another. The personal and the political, Theremin. You're using one to muddle the other." "Come," he said. 44. They stepped from the tent. The early light of Onos was a pink glow on the eastern horizon. High overhead, Tano and Setha had emerged from the clouds, and the twin suns, now at their zenith, had a radiance that was strange and wonderful to behold. There was one more. Far off in the north, the small, hard red sphere that was the little sun Dovim was shining like a tiny ruby set in the forehead of the sky. 4 suns, Theremin said. "A sign of luck." All about them in the apostles' camp there was the bustle of activity. The trucks were being loaded. The tents were coming down. Theremin caught sight of Philemon far across the other side, directing a team of workers. The apostle waved to Theremin, who nodded in return. "You hate the idea that the apostles will rule the world," Sephira said, "and yet you're still willing to give your allegiance to Philemon? Why? What sense does that make?" Quietly, Theremin said, "Because there's no other hope." "Is that what you think?" He nodded. It began to sink in after Philemon had been talking with me for a couple of hours. Every rational instinct in me tells me not to trust Philemon and his crew of fanatics. Whatever else he may be, there's no doubt that Philemon's a power-hungry manipulator. Very ruthless, very dangerous. But what other chance is there? Alt and all the petty little bosses along the highway? It could take 1,000,000 years to weld all the new provinces into a global economy. Solomon's got the authority to make the whole world kneel to him, or to Mondior, rather. Listen, Sephira, most of mankind is lost in madness. There are millions of crazies loose out there now. Only strong-minded ones like you and me and Binet have been able to recover, or very stupid ones. But for the others, the mass of humanity, it'll be months, or years, or never before they can think straight again. A charismatic prophet like Mondior, much as I loathe the idea, may be the only answer." "No other option, then?" Not for us, Sephira.
Why not?
Look, Sephira, I believe that what matters is healing. Everything else is secondary to that. The world has suffered a terrible wound and has inflicted a terrible wound on itself. Well, that's not how I see it. The fires were a response to a vast change of circumstances. They never would have happened if the eclipse hadn't yanked our curtain away and shown us the stars. But the wounds go on and on. One leads to another now. Aldenal is a wound. These new little independent provinces are wounds. The crazies killing each other in the forest or hunting down fugitive university professors are wounds. And Fahleman? He's the biggest wound of all. Yes and no. Of course, he's peddling fanaticism and mysticism, but there's discipline there. People believe in what he's selling. Even the crazies, even the ones with sick minds. He's a wound so big, he can swallow all the others. He can heal the world, Sephira. And then, from within, we can try to heal what he has done. But only from within. If we join him, we stand a chance. If we set ourselves up in opposition, we'll be swept aside like fleas. What are you saying, then? We have our choice between rallying behind him and becoming part of the ruling elite that will bring the world back from insanity, or becoming wanderers and outlaws. Which do you want, Sephira? I want a third choice. There isn't any. The Umgando Bunch doesn't have the force of will to form a workable government. People like Altenal don't have the scruples. Fahleman already controls half of what used to be the Federal Republic of Sorrow. He's certain to prevail over the rest. It'll be centuries before the reign of reason returns, Sephira, regardless of what you and I do. So you say it's better to join him and try to control the direction in which the new society goes than to oppose him simply because we don't like the kind of fanaticism he represents? Exactly. Exactly. But to cooperate in handing the world over to religious fanaticism. The world has made its way up from religious fanaticism before, hasn't it? The important thing now is to find some way out of the chaos. Fahleman and his crew offer the only visible hope of that. Think of their faith as a machine that'll drive civilization at a time when all the other machinery is broken. That's the only thing that counts now. First, fix the world. Then, hope our descendants will get tired of the mystical fellows in the robes and hoods. Do you see what I'm saying, Sephira? Do you? She nodded in a strange, vague way as though she were responding in her sleep. Theramon watched as she walked slowly away from him toward the clearing where they had been surprised by the sentries of the apostles the evening before. It seemed like years ago. She stood a long while by herself there in the light of the four suns. How beautiful she looks, Theramon thought. How I love her. How strange this all has turned out to be. He waited. All about him, the breakup of the apostles' camp was reaching a pitch of activity, robed and hooded figures running back and forth past him. Fahleman came over.
Well?
We're thinking it over, Theramon said.
We? I had the impression you were with us, no matter what.
Theramon eyed him steadily. I'm with you if Sephira is. Otherwise, no.
Whatever you say. We'd hate to lose a man with your skills at communications, though. Not to mention Dr. Sephira's expertise with the artifacts of the past.
Theramon smiled. Let's see how skillful I've been at communicating just now, eh? Fahleman nodded and walked away, back to the trucks that were being loaded. Theramon looked toward Sephira. She was facing east, toward Onos, while the light of Setha and Tano descended on her in a dazzling stream from above, and out of the north came the slender red spear of Dovim's beam. Four suns, the best of omens. Sephira was coming back now, trotting across the field. Her eyes were shining and she seemed to be laughing. She came running up to him. Well, Theramon asked, what do you say? She took his hand in hers. All right, Theramon, so be it. Almighty Fahleman is our leader and I will follow him whithersoever he telleth me to go, with one condition. Go on, what is it? The same one I mentioned when we were in his tent. I won't wear the robe, I absolutely will not. If he insists on the robe, the deal is off. Theramon nodded happily. It was going to be all right. After nightfall came daybreak and rebirth. Out of the devastation, a new Kalgash would rise and he and Sephira would have a voice, a powerful voice in creating it. I think that can be arranged, he replied. Let's go talk to Fahleman and see what he says. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Nightfall by Isaac Asimov and Robert Silverberg. Copyright 1990 by Nightfall Incorporated and Agberg Limited. And performance copyright 1991 by Brilliance Corporation. All rights reserved.